Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Welcome, everybody, to Rallycast. This is season 2, the 5th episode of our Dreamers series, Imagine If. And we're really thankful that you're still here with us. I'm JP, joined by my co-host, Carl.
Hey, everybody. Good to be here. Thank you, JP. Appreciate the introduction. Looking forward to another great discussion.
Yeah, and we're keeping our return listeners on their toes. But if you're a new listener, my name is John Paul, go by JP. And just very excited for today's conversation. The topic, as we all know, will coalesce by the end. But our guest is here physically. And we're joined by Bo Hayden. Tell us a little bit about yourself and our listeners.
Yeah. Thank you so much for inviting me here. Yeah, where do I start? I'm an American that's been in Europe for many years now. I came over to play professional basketball. That's why I'm so tall. And then, as everyone does, I transitioned from basketball into intellectual property, right? That's what we all do.
That's right.
So I continued to do my master's and my PhD when I was playing basketball. And I was very interested in the knowledge economy. How do you create wealth and welfare from primarily knowledge? Of course, knowledge has been around forever, but how do we do it where we actually can package it and transact it and create a whole another set of value propositions just based on knowledge? And that, you know, and that means you have to control knowledge, and that sounds a lot like intellectual property. So that led me to create a center for intellectual property in Sweden and built up a lot of relationships over the last 25 years. This is our 25th anniversary. And now I also work at UC Berkeley, focused on technology leadership, which is another way of thinking about IP, how to control and be the leader in technology. And get to do a bunch of fun, interesting tasks all over the world these days with really interesting people like yourself. So looking forward to our discussion today. Don't be too tough on me.
Well, you know, I was never good on the basketball court, so make sure we just don't get boxed out, and we'll see how many puns we can get in.
That was a good one. Not to put you on the spot here, Bo, but we did our homework in very, very nice form on the jumper. A lot of silk in those highlights. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, in the highlights, you never miss a shot in the highlight film, right? So you always look pretty good. So even Giannis probably looks good from the free throw line in a highlight film.
That's right.
But I did have a good jumper. I did. I was a poor man's Larry Bird, you know. So a little bit of everything. Maybe now poor man's Doncic would be the modern version, right?
That's right. No, it's funny. We share that common thread. I played basketball, not on the level that you did, but as a three man. And actually, for those listeners who do not know, shout out to our chief commercial officer, Andreas Selander. He shares both the basketball background in Europe with Bo, and also in the IP world, you know, they've crossed paths. And I think that's how we kind of landed here today, right, JP, in terms of the connection. So a lot of semi-pro and professional basketball / IP vibes.
We can almost put a team together now. That's good.
We're getting there.
Yeah. Very cool. I'll be the guy that they traded Doncic for, you know, that no one remembers, you know, like the Sam Bowie of the bunch.
Wally Szczerbiak, former Celtic. There you go.
Yeah, but I think our previous listeners will know this is, you know, it's no reason other than chance. But I think you're our third or fourth Swede, even if it's an honorary Swede. But yeah, just really excited. And I know, Bo, with your background, and as the listeners know from previous episodes and those that just want to get their ear chewed off when they run into me at the pub, the business element of IP, of patents, you know, more than patents based on our previous episode when it comes to, you know, creator rights, is really just a subject that still doesn't have the mainstream weight that I think it should, especially going into this new era of not innovation, but inventiveness. So I think it's good to kind of look into maybe a top-down approach in a sense of us on the ground floor. We know the value of patents, of IP. I think most of our listeners also as well. So we're not here to do a, you know, patents 101, but what if the board or the top level strategic decision makers looked at IP, patents, marks, et cetera, as what was it you said, a profit center versus a cost center in actual value. So I think that'd be a good opportunity to have a start and spark our conversation in a sense. You know, the jump ball would be that.
All right. Yeah, that's a good topic. That's one, it's basically one that we created our whole center around 25 years ago, was how to see intellectual property integral in creating value for businesses and for society. And I think one of the issues is that it's a bit ubiquitous, right? It's all around us all the time, but we don't really perceive it. I mean, people see brands, but they don't think about the intellectual property behind it. They see technology, they see software, they see all these things. Once in a while, something comes up that pushes people to see this, but for most of the time, they don't see it. And a lot of the value is created and flows into other things, right? So if you had the, if the board, I think it's a mixture, right? It's important to have this top-down approach, as you said. I think we've been working at SIP for a long time, pushing up, you know, from bottom up, how to get IP people to be more business thinking. I think that that's worked quite well to a certain extent, but I think it's hard to explain the value of IP without really being, without really having this clear understanding of the business language. And what would be best, of course, is if the board members of the company were the ones that wanted to ask the key questions and were pulling as opposed to pushing, maybe as a way of thinking about it. So if you take this thought experiment that you mentioned, if all IP departments had to be profit centers instead of cost centers, then you wouldn't, you know, as a cost center, you get your money, you do your thing, you create some value, but you don't really see it. But if you're a profit center, now you have to go to everyone and convince them to give you money to do something, right? And it would be very easy for those companies that generate a lot of money through licensing. But there's a lot of companies, and even those companies create a lot of value through IP in other ways. But then you'd have to go to the head of the business unit and say, we're thinking of creating a patent portfolio. How much is it worth to you, right, to do that? And then that would force this conversation about why we do what we do. When it's a call center, it can kind of happen off to the side. If it creates value through products, it probably isn't going to be credited to the IP department. It'll be credited to the sales department, likely. But if you had to have a conversation to say, well, you know, we're not going to create any patents for you unless you pay for them, and how much is it worth to you? So this kind of profit thinking, it disciplines the discussion, and it forces there to be this understanding about how value is created through, you know, through different mechanisms in a company. Because it is a lot of different actors that come together to produce value. And I think IP is not as represented as it should be.
And why do you think that is? And because everything that you said are drivers towards an IPR in a sense. You need to increase sales. You need to disrupt the market. You need to, you know, untap potential revenue from a product. But everything is what's leading towards a decision to file a patent. Why would you say that there's such a, let's say, gap between the connecting of the dots in a sense?
Well, I think there's a, how do you say, a division of labor issue. In Adam Smith's Pin Factory, you know, they break the pin construction into like 18 pieces and they produce a hell of a lot more pins than one person producing the pin. The problem is that one person is just doing a small part of it. And I think there's a division of labor in IP where there's this implicit understanding that IP is important, and therefore let's do it, and let's do it very efficiently. But we have this tyranny of efficiency where we're doing things very efficient, but we've stopped discussing whether it's actually valuable or not, right?
Well,
there's
yeah,
an assumption that it must be valuable, but is it really, right? We need to ever so often we need to go back up and see the big picture and ask the question. Sorry, Carl, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I guess it begs the question of like how far does the understanding of that value reach? And you're looking at like the efficiencies, and you know, there might be an understanding that you're creating value within the, you know, the IP organization itself, or you know, the R&D organization itself, but you know, it's where does it stop? You know, how does it get, you know, further than that? I think that that's part of the question too, is, you know, why doesn't it? And if it doesn't, what can be done to kind of change that?
Yeah, so there's a need, and we've done this for many years, trying to educate business people about IP and IP people about business. They need to meet somewhere. They both need each other. But we haven't necessarily been as entrepreneurially good in IP, I think, at communicating the value. And that's because we're a bit specialized, right? If you're specialized in being an engineer that knows how to create patents, for example, then maybe that's not necessarily the specialty that gets you to be an entrepreneurial communicator in a business strategy sense, right? So maybe some of these positions are not necessarily, they're designed for specialists, not for the generalists or strategists, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that, as you know, as time goes by, all specialties go away over time, right? So you need to keep your head up and see how you need to justify what you do and how you can become more valuable for the company.
And I think that's in line with the episode 2 that we had about, imagine if looking back, you had the confidence to speak up, because the view that you're saying now is not a new view. View was there 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It doesn't take AI to see the value of patent data. But I think, like when you said tyranny of efficiency, that's a good way of looking at it, in a sense of the drive to optimize creates blind spots where opportunity exists. And it's also another thing where you said because a patent right is for the better of mankind. IP is a human right. And if you don't see the benefit of what you're creating for the benefit of others, not necessarily your own, then that also kind of closes a shop. Thank you, Ben. We'll edit this one. Well, that kind of closes the shop a little bit. What would you say, Bo? Because it seems that trying to teach IP business sense and business IP sense, the way you're describing it is two positive charge magnets. They'll never meet. What's crazy? Is that, and then what would you, sorry to get closer, what would you say is a way to get those magnets to connect?
Yeah, that is the question that we've been asking for the last 25 years. So when we teach business to IP people and teach IP to business people, what do you think is easier? What would be your prediction?
Business to IP.
It's actually easier to teach IP to business people.
Maybe,
except for the fact that no business person, I shouldn't say no, but most business people won't sign up for a course with the word intellectual property in it. But if they go and it's taught properly, they actually, because business people, these are the people who buy books at the, to read on the airplane about how to make more money, right? And once they learn that IP is a tool for them to make more money, they're in, right? Once they understand that, they start to ask, and how long does a patent last? And what is those dates again? And all that. They start to pull that because they see that this could be valuable. And they're always looking for something. So business people, the struggle is to get them to come into the room in the first place. Sometimes I deceive them. I say, we're going to talk about advanced innovation management. And then I talk about IP, which is technically correct. And they're like, oh, this is great. I haven't heard about it like this before. When it comes to IP for business, IP people are very busy. They're specialists. They have a lot of work to get done to say, now you need to understand the whole business of the company and take that into account. I think people want to do it, but it's an effort, right? And it's not really what they get paid to do. And how many people want to raise their hand and say, I like to discuss how much value we're creating for real now, and let's have a discussion. Could you put the spotlight on me? And I like to do this extra work, and I don't want any extra pay, really. Just I want extra accountability. It's you really have to be entrepreneurial to pull this off, I think. We're business people. Have more room, more space for this.
And would you say the immediacy of, let's say, the return on investment on making a decision on a marketing campaign or a new sales strategy is more immediate than what you receive on a patent, let's say? And this is in no way mean to our business users, the shiny ball syndrome that affects a lot of decision making. Could that also be potentially?
Yeah.
What I think could be slowing that down?
That's another good point. So, we want to see what's right in front of us. We have the quarterly earnings reports. IP is definitely a midterm type of asset, right? My joke is, if you're a good IP person, you leave every 6 years before anyone finds out what's really happened for what you've done. But that's a little bit of the truth in the joke, that you have to kind of get an organization to think short term, to think longer term. And that just adds to the communicative challenge. Remember, when you're a call center, you're not really asked to say how much money you're creating for the company. You receive a certain budget and you spend it. And therefore, there's some anonymity in the call center, right? You can do your job, do it well, and be a little bit under the radar. Whereas if you're a profit center, you need to have more income than cost, otherwise you're in trouble. And that's why the thought experiment is so useful, because it forces you to say, how am I creating value, and get other people to agree.
And that's a good segue to kind of a more future thought. And everyone's afraid of AI in some way. My parents are afraid that AI is going to do things that they see on Instagram, you know, the videos they send.
I'm glad to see they're on Instagram. That's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, that's how they see the grandchildren. But everyone has a fear that AI is going to take their job or in some way. And, you know, I'm always like, it's pretty obvious conversation now, so it's not, you know, beat the horse while it's down in a sense. But there's more of a risk if you're seen as a cost center to be deemed an asset to automate when the other way around. So I think when we were kind of chatting last week, this idea of heading for the higher ground and a few comments around potential roles that could be automated, such as these decision maker roles, could go to AI. But what if AI kind of took over IP in a sense? What impact would that have in a dystopian sense? What do you think?
Dystopian, yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting to think about this, and I know IP Rally works with AI-enabled tools. I think we're all in a movie, right, where in one of those movies where a big tsunami is coming and we're all heading up to higher ground when it comes to AI. It's only, in my mind, it's really only a question of time. Is it 100 years? Is it 10 years? And so gradually the water level will keep going up. And I remember when Kasparov said, you know, only a real, you know, generative AI system, you know, could beat someone in chess. And that actually turned out not to be that complicated at all, right? Relatively speaking. So a lot of tasks are going to go away without having there to be, you know, a singularity. So this is going to keep going. And it makes sense, because it's like that everywhere, right? All tasks are automated away over time. I mean, a couple hundred years ago, we had, you know, half to 80% or 90% of the population doing farming, and now it's less than 2%, right? And we have more food than we ever had. Same with automation and in factories. We're going to have more things being produced with less people. It's all because of this. So the first question would be, why would we expect IP to be different? I know there'll be people that'll have the Kasparov thinking, well, you know, a machine can't do a patent. A machine can't beat me in chess. I'm pretty sure a machine can do it. And then of course things will start to go very quickly, right? Because if the patent office has a machine for checking validity and you have a machine for creating patents, those two machines will connect to each other and we'll have patents and everything handled in seconds. Dystopian. Well, that's a good question. I think the dystopian part is typically that when it goes to the next level, I know that everyone that works in the patent profession doing tasks like, say, patent attorneys, they enjoy their job. It's a good job. But almost all jobs in some way are cost to the organization, right? Even so, on the next level, you would have people that, say, do the inventing. And then you have people that help patent the inventions. So the next level would be, will the machines do the inventing as well? And then will the machines be the CEO and the board as well? You know, it just keeps moving, right?
Well, the machines are already kind of doing the inventing. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I mean, it's kind of happening. It's starting to happen. You know, it's there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of questions around, where does the inventorship lie? How do we regulate that? You know, but a lot of it is fear-based. I think a lot of it is just kind of, this is something that's moving so quickly and we don't know how to get our arms around it.
Yeah. So just to finish is that, you know, humans are like, what do we do? You know, I like my job. You know, some people don't like their job. If they won the lottery, that would be the last day of that work. A lot of people like their job and they don't want machines to do it, right? They would like to do it. And I feel, and there's going to be a transition in society during that time period. That's for sure. That's the dystopian side, that people enjoy their work and they might not be able to get to do it the same way.
And I think also, it would be nice to get a very quick patentability or office action response from the patent office in minutes versus 18 months. But what do you think the risks are of the lack of contextual knowledge of IP rights and IP value, let's say, on the earlier conversation? to those that may be just blindly leading towards full automation? And what impact do you think that can have?
Yeah, so I think that that's a good question. And that is related to the value discussion. If you are, let's say most companies are not going to have a profit center in the IP department, but let's call it a value center instead. Which is just a name to give to frame the thinking. If you're forced to think about what is the value in what you do, then everything you do will be done within that framework, which will be good. And then you could start to automate the things that you know are in line with your strategic vision. If you just automate the things that you're doing where you don't know if they're creating value or not, then of course that's going to be problematic. Now, in the past, SAP, before they would come in and automate information systems for companies, they would bring in a consultant, management consultant firm, to make sure the processes were done properly, because you don't want to automate the mess, right? So now is a good time to start to think about that as we come in and automate. We don't want to automate for automation's sake. Now is a good time to lift up the head, see the forest for the trees, and think, why do we do what we do? Why? I think we need a why campaign, and where we have the CEO of the company sitting on the shoulder every time. You're like, I think I'm going to file an opposition. Why? And then when you answer, CEO says, so what? Explain it to me in earnings per share, right? You know, and I think that would be very helpful, right? And then we automate the things that can be automated, which only makes sense, right? I mean, the title for your house is important, right? That's the property right for your house. But who was the guy who titled your house? You know, is that a button that they push at the realtor office? Is it? It's been automated away. So everything gets automated. Some things are more complicated. They take longer. They're further up the mountain.
And to you said that the why, I always try to say, be a three-year-old. Someone's like, I'm doing this, why?
The problem is here, why?
Yeah. Not to be mean, but it's more just to really understand that why is so important. I say that as my 13-month-old is crying in the other room, and I'm also wondering why.
We can't hear her, so.
Yeah, good.
Exactly.
But I think one of the biggest and I think another reason I was excited to have you on, Bo, is kind of this kind of holistic engagement. And for the successful implementation of IP respect, no, respect's not the good word, IP understanding on the board level, like you said, it also needs to be understood on the engineering level, on the management level, all the way down to the intern level. So they understand that they have a good idea not to create any prior art or publish any prior art that needs to be top down. So I'd like to kind of ask you a mini imagine if, maybe you wouldn't have a job, but imagine if IP was everywhere in the company. What impact do you think that would have on future growth and future ability of valuable patents?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that IP is everywhere in the company, right? The question is it managed properly, right? It's a little bit like an American healthcare system. We say some people don't have healthcare insurance. Well, they can show up at the emergency room, so they're getting healthcare. It's just not managed very well, right? It's a bad management. And so that's the same thing here. It's depending on how you, I always like to start out by what is the definition of IP with IP professionals and business people. And I usually get three answers, and I'm about to write a blog on this, so this will come out shortly. But some people will say like technology, software, designs, brands. Some people will say patents, trademark rights, copyright. And some people will talk about business value. And you have to bring them all together, right? And those don't all happen just in the IP department. Those are happening everywhere in the company. So everyone is working with IP, whether they know it or not. The question is, how much better would it be if they coherently understood what they were doing together and can bring all these aspects together in a way that says, how do we control the most valuable intangible assets in the firm to create competitive advantage? And it would seem that eventually that will need to happen. You could call it IP at the source. The example was quality movement in the 80s. They had a quality manager, a quality team, quality circles, quality department. And then one day someone said, you know, shouldn't everyone be thinking about quality? And someone's like, yeah, that makes sense. And so I think we'll have the same thing. So we have an IP department, we have certain people, but eventually it's going to need to be IP at the source, because it's everywhere. and it has to be thought about. People have to think about what they do as IP in addition to the other ways they think about it.
But I think it's a larger mindset. I'm not going to name names, but I think it's maybe good to show some examples. In my experience in the last 10 years, there have been quite a few companies that I've engaged with and worked with where I was surprised at the, I guess you could say, obtuse attitude they had, in a sense that we're the market leaders. Why do we need to see what anyone else is filing? We're ones that are leading our industry. Why do we need to see if there's any prior art? Our inventions are the top. They're at the top of the mountain, as they say. And then I look back and look at the data and look at them and be like, you're going to be surprised. Like you said, Bo, in 6 years, you best be updating that LinkedIn. So there are, I think, common examples where, and I know, Carl, you have a great example where on the other side, it's managed really well. But it'd be great to hear, Carl, from you and also from you, Bo, some examples, I think, for our listeners to kind of maybe potentially introspectively see if there's some risks in the way that they're operating.
Well, I think on the note of, there's two things there, right? I think on the note of we're the industry leaders, why do we have to worry about what's going on with, you know, other portfolios? Why do we need to be concerned with that? Quite frankly, I think it's because there's some of these leaders are so large and they're so impactful that they don't care because they'll cover it anyway. And it's going to be something where it's like, okay, you know, the competitors are doing these things. Well, you know, we might even know that and know that we're going to kind of like duke it out over that and that we're going to have the upper hand. And that's just the way that it is. And the other part of that is, you mentioned how it's done the other way. And, you know, I've mentioned this before. You know, I've worked for a couple of organizations that are the leaders in their respective fields of technology. And, you know, one of them, you know, I named it before in a prior podcast, but, you know, Sonos and the success of that company and the competitive market in which it exists. When you think about audio and how costs have come down for some of these larger companies to really get themselves into the market with, you know, speakers and voice control and all of these things, that is a company where the value of the IP and the ideas and the future looking kind of aspect of that has been talked about from the start. It's kind of built into the DNA from the sales teams to the marketing teams, all the way up to the executive teams, and that having a, you know, a pretty big seat at the table, and them really trying to stand up for what they kind of planted the seeds for a long time ago with, you know, the vision that they had before there was ubiquity and, you know, everyone having, you know, Wi-Fi and the golden age of audio streaming. And it is really, it's really a cool thing to be a part of when there's the kind of IP reaching out into the organization and being a part of the DNA of it. But it's just not common. I mean, that's the reason why we're having this discussion today, right? Like, imagine if it was everywhere in the company and it was understood that way. I don't know that it necessarily is. So I'm over here kind of like waving this flag and saying, hey, it's pretty nice when it is. But, you know, even that, you saw, we all have seen, I think, what's happened with, you know, Sonos and Google going back and forth and so on and so forth. And so it's not easy. But, you know, Bo, I'd be interested to hear kind of what your perspectives are on those things.
Yeah, those are very good points. I wrote a paper with a case study with the Sonos, a Google case. And Sonos, of course, has a very large patent portfolio. And they, of course, tried to collaborate in different ways. And that's the reason why you have patents. You know, Elon Musk said patents are for the weak, and he was correct, but not in the way that he meant it. He was being mean, but he is correct. They are for the weak. I mean, even the pharmaceutical industry would be in a very weak position without patents, right? Anytime you invested a lot of money in something that anyone can observe cheaply and imitate, without the IP system, people wouldn't put in that time anymore to do that. So you are in a weak position. That's important on the one hand, as you say, Carl, that companies put a lot of effort in, especially smaller companies, and almost all companies were small at one point in time, because that is your sling to be in the game with Goliath, right? Once you become Goliath, of course, then you have other mechanisms. You have other tools in the tool belt that you can pull out and use. But for small companies, you really need to think about this. The other side of it is the analytics, right? I really don't know why people wouldn't use analytics more, and not only the IP department, but the use of patent analytics by other parts of an organization. And even in countries, right, I've spoken to the U.S. government that, you know, the U.S. Patent Office should facilitate the other parts of the government in the U.S., and I've talked about it in Sweden. this is a great amount of information to understand where your country is and your companies are in relation to other people. And for those that say, we don't need to look because we already know, I can tell you after a lot of projects, hundreds of projects, where I usually have a very smart group of people working for me digging into this, that they almost always found things that people didn't know. And these were the smartest people in the world in this field, right? So it would very much surprise me that someone would not find something that they weren't sure of, and especially when there's new trends in new areas, right? Because you think you're moving in this area, but there can be another technology that can solve the same thing, but it's not the same technology that you're working on, right? And sometimes that can be quite distant from where you are. You know, would you have seen, you know, autonomous driving? How early could you have seen that in the patent literature? It is a window, and it would be like a general saying, you know, general, would you like a satellite photo of where everybody is, where the enemy is? No, thank you. We'll just drive right down the middle of the road and see what happens. It's a little ridiculous that it's not used more often. And when we teach it at Berkeley, especially now, the students, that's one of the things that they're like, well, we never knew that this existed. This is like a treasure trove of useful information to answer all kinds of business questions, right? So I agree.
Yeah, I used to, and for me, it clicked in a sense of my degrees in entrepreneurship and from San Francisco State. And a lot of it was, you know, everything around Steve Pestle forecasting, understanding, you know, the financials of it, the social aspect. But when I first saw a patent dashboard, I was like, this is confirmatory. This is exploratory. Like you said, hey, patents are solutions. There are solutions that have taken a lot of knowledge to get to a point where it's novel and it's non-obvious. Two really big hurdles. That's why I think with Andreas, we always talk about that. Was it 80% of patents that are opposed are killed because they either are misconstrued by whoever's reviewing it before it gets to PTAB, or they just don't meet that threshold, that criteria. And I always look at patents as that knowledge input, but also you can even get as granular as understanding of your competitors doing a co-partnership with a certain university that specializes in a technology. And that gives you an understanding way advanced in time of what they're doing with that technology, for example, that kind of inference. But
the point you made right there, actually, just quick, is very good, because let's say that you're in the patent department and you get something from R&D, we've created this thing, and you find out that it's not novel or it's obvious. That would have been good to know before you put the time into doing the R&D to put it out, right? And it probably was known. So you know, it's not a good thing if something, whether you need a patent, that's another issue. But if it's not patentable, you know, that's actually not a good thing, is it? You want novel and not obvious, no matter whether you patent or not.
I think the patent database is more important outside of patents. What if you're trying to come up with a solution, someone's already done it? Why not find out who's the owner of that IP, reach out, license it, bring it through, save yourself the time and the effort to try to reinvent the wheel.
Exactly. At least know who are the people out there and what's been done, right? And I think in the U.S., there's been a long history of lawyers saying, don't look into it because then you can't get hit for triple damages. But now I've seen some courts say, well, if you don't put any effort into it, we're going to give you damages for willful ignorance, which I think is reasonable, because you can't, the whole system of the patent system is to disclose. And if no one's going to look, well, it doesn't really function properly then.
Yeah, it's the old, I can't hear you, I can't see.
This is an interesting point. I think it goes beyond just like organizationally, like just thinking about, you know, I have friends who are like entrepreneurs who are kind of trying to come up with ideas for things and, you know, bouncing things off me. I have one friend in particular who does this all the time. And I love being able to go into like IP Rally or a tool like that from the start and just get a very high level layman's overview of what's out there on a very basic level. And that's just from a conversation I'm having with someone that's an entrepreneurial minded person. Imagine if that was something that everyone had access to.
There's even at those early stages. Right,
right. Exactly. It's my very first on the spot imagine if that I've come up with in the podcast. So I finally have earned my way onto the Rallycast.
Yeah, you've earned your pin.
Yeah. These tools are so good that if, you know, you go back home after a conversation and use them and come back the next day, people will be like, how did you get up to speed like this?
Well, no one has this, right? Like, I mean, it's just as we talked on a prior podcast about, like, we're in an IP economy, right? And that it is all around us. And those of us who work in this space, I think we kind of wear the badge proud, but it is. I mean, everywhere you look, I mean, everything that you look at, there's something behind it, most likely that started there. And, you know, it would be interesting if it was something that everyone, you know, that had this kind of entrepreneurial mindset had an easy access to an app or something on, like, a smartphone or anything that they could use to kind of get started there. I mean, I don't know if, you know, lawyers who work in this field would be that happy about it being so ubiquitous, just because maybe their value would not be as great, maybe until further down the line, but at least getting a directional sense of what's out there and what can be done. I mean, it's really, I think it's fascinating. So I don't know, it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, these tools are democratizing in a way, right? They give everyone a relatively easy, accessible chance to be quite knowledgeable quite quickly.
Do you think that there may be a generational impact going forward? Because I feel that, you know, I think some of the biases are trained biases from an older era where, you know, the willful infringement and the ways around it and say, you know, I didn't see anything, to where maybe some of those that grew up in that risky generation aren't as open when they're training the next generation to come up to look at it as, hey, do search, do see if there is. Because I think if I was a business owner and my engineering team or my legal team were aware at first, and their attitude wasn't, oh my God, we failed out. It was, okay, let's design around it. Let's make it better. And in the end, that's a much valuable benefit of that knowledge, which would kind of bring me to another kind of topic, which is kind of segueing into, you said earlier, knowledge economy. I said that, you know, patents are a solution, and patent search tool is a solution database. I think a lot of the success that you have is by trying to find somebody with a solution, not somebody using the same tool as you to find that solution. That's the big value. But what if this knowledge was easy to monetize? Like, easy to get a patent granted, and you can just chip off the block if you need it every now and then, or, you know, the gig economy, but a knowledge economy.
Yeah, I mean, that is basically the thinking behind SIP. So our tagline, how to facilitate the transformation of knowledge into wealth and welfare. And of course, typically in an industrial era, you took knowledge and you put it into a physical product and you sold the physical product. And the thing that makes the knowledge economy, in my mind, the knowledge economy, and not just because knowledge has always been in the economy, is that you would be able to trade it as is, right? And then you can have a division of innovative labor, as they say. So, you know, you can have some people who just only come up with ideas and then trade them. But if you can't trade knowledge, then you have to vertically integrate into the production of packaging of it as well, which is less efficient. And there's where we have the problem. The problem is that it's not, you know, the thing that makes knowledge so valuable but also so difficult to control is that it's non-rival. We can all have it in our head at the same time. So who really owns it? Who really can use it? If you already know it, but I tell you that I have a patent on it, so even though you know how to do it, you can't do it. You're going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out that maybe my patent doesn't block you, right? So if you see the transfer of technology with patents, with knowledge, where if you read the patent, it wouldn't help you enough, you see that happens much easier. But if you're just trying to transfer the access to do something, that has really been very difficult. And because in many systems, if we take the US, for example, it's very expensive and time consuming. It's no one's really incentivized to make a deal on any high level immediately because it's just so difficult to enforce your patents. In fact, you could argue that if your patents were infinitely difficult to enforce, then you wouldn't have a patent system, right? So you can have it so that it's too much, and you can have it that it's too much. You have to find this right area. And I think it hasn't been easy enough to package and transfer knowledge to people to be able to create the vision of this knowledge economy. I mean, it happens, but it's not happening that efficiently.
And do you think, like, looking at standard essentiality as one opportunity, one looks like, you know, from the outside looking in, as an opportunity to create an open, because you're essentially forcing the holders of that IP to license it because it's an essential. But that's in a very specific industry. Yeah. Why doesn't that exist elsewhere?
Yeah, so I think that anytime you have a system, right, and that's what, when I talk to people about standard essential patents, I'm always trying to get everyone to understand that this is a very collective system. Everyone agreed to throw their ideas and have them compete to see which ones are best to get into the standard. And for being able to do that, they were allowed to claim patents on that so that they would get some type of compensation, and it has to be done in a fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory way. So here you see you've created a system where you incentivize people to put in their technology to be compensated, but in a fair and reasonable way, so the people that are using the standard are willing to go and build products on that. And so that operates within its own logic. When you don't have that whole system and that kind of contractual and relationship between actors, it's less obvious in one moment whether if I might try to get the best result for myself in this moment, because there's not going to be another moment. In the standardization area, there's this standard, and then next is the next standard, and then the next one. If you don't, you know, if you misbehave, in game theory, it's called a repeated game. People learn, right? So you can fool me. Was it fool me once? Shame on you. Should fool me twice? Shame on me, right? That's the thinking. See, if I did that better than Bush.
I was just going to say that we're getting into dangerous territory.
So you have this issue that some ecosystems are designed in a way that people need each other, and it doesn't do good to push one side out too much. But then there's other situations where it's just this one-time situation, and then both sides are incentivized to get the most out of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it seems that you still need that human element, in a sense. It seems difficult to automate that sort of decision-making. And I know, like, when we're saying heading for higher ground, I think we didn't mention the analogy in the beginning, but, you know, it's, imagine AI is a tsunami. You know, if you don't get to higher ground, it's gonna take you. So the human element is this awareness. So the whole point is trying to understand how to kind of get to that higher ground and survive. So what about that human side? You know, the fears of infringement, or the lack of knowledge of the value, everything that we've kind of been discussing now. Do you think this is a human-led change, or is it going to be something that it may be too late for the decision makers to see that they should have done something? What, in your view, is the kind of human side of everything?
When it comes to IP in general, or for AI?
Yeah, on the subject of the growth of knowledge, respect, and understanding of IP throughout the business.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, is that human led? Is that us, like me going to Carl, the same thing? We need more enablement. Is it more, you know, consulting firms looking at it more, like you said,
yeah,
prepare now for success in the future?
Yeah, I think it's and it's the same with AI, right? There's a fear. Everything is kind of pushed by fear and greed, right? Where there's an opportunity, and maybe that sounds too polemic, but people are looking for opportunities, or they're afraid of losing position. You know, this is what drives companies and people. If you're comfortable in what you do, you probably don't want to change. And then and this is what happens to companies. Most companies don't survive forever, right? Because they were very innovative, and then they became very efficient at doing something right. And then that efficiency trapped them, the tyranny of efficiency trapped them in one way, and they're not able to change for the next thing that comes, right? And people can be the same. We become very specialized. We like to do things. Things are changing. We don't want to do it. And then, of course, eventually the old way is gone, right? Everything leaves eventually, right? So the old way will be gone. And so if you want people to do this, it will be because people have a fear that they need to do better, or they'll lose what they have, or a greed, or an opportunist way of thinking that this is a chance to do more. And that can be both from the IP side and from the business side. And I made a joke of my colleague, Ulf Pietersen, who I created SIP with. We joked that in Sweden, we should create a state-sponsored patent assertion entity that went around suing companies as a mode of patent value awareness. Because if you get sued, usually the CEO of the company has to take notice, and now we can start a conversation. So it was a little extreme idea, but there's some usefulness in it, as you can see, because there needs to be some
just
necessity,
scare them.
Right? Yeah, you need necessity. People don't change without necessity, I don't think, because there are people that are changing and entrepreneurial all the time. But in general, most people, and this is human nature, you like repetition. You like it to be consistent and constant and whatnot. And there's a good feeling in that. And to be told that half of what you learned is not useful anymore, you need to learn some more things. Some people find that exhilarating and some very, very scary.
Yeah, it's like guerrilla marketing in a sense. You break into someone's house to sell them a security system.
Right, exactly. I always think that's what happens. And when my neighbors get broken into, I think, was that the alarm company? No, I'm just saying.
Maybe it's their other neighbors wanting to keep the streets safer so that everyone has an alarm system, so they're just going in.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to look at that. You know, and like I said, in my experience, I think every organization has the successful ones and the non-successful ones is a blend of personalities. And that's what drives a lot of the great decision-making, some of the poor decision-making, if you look at some marketing campaigns of late. But it really is just that human nature. And I think that's kind of driving a lot of, hopefully, the decision making. And, you know, to go back to the basketball analogy, you know, you still, you know, need to have feet on the floor, you know, boots on the ground, and a human nature. You don't have robots playing basketball or baseball. I know Major League Baseball is refusing to get robot umpires for the nature of the game, for better or for worse. But, you know, I hope that us in the IP space, in the patent space, corporate decision making, we're when the AI tsunami settles, in a sense, and that new lake is created, and we have a nice position, happy and healthy at the top.
Is, I mean, and that is the issue, right? When humans want to be in the center, right? We want to be in the center of the action, and this is the thinking that you want to keep improving. I think, you know, my colleagues at quality management department, and we made fun of them a little bit ago, but now I'll give them some credit. They say you have two jobs, and one is to do your job, and another one's to improve your job. So you need to be constantly improving. You should be improving to some, that should be interesting in itself, and you should always be moving into more interesting things. And that should naturally help you on this progression, because the water level, AI or not, is always rising. And maybe, you know, we talk a lot about industry 4.0. We're going to have to talk about humanity 4.0. And what does it mean in the future that doesn't have work in the exact same way? We should all want to get better because it's a more interesting work, right? At the same time, the water level is starting to creep up on us to give us a little boost.
Yeah. And I think that's a good ending point for today's episode. I think it really ties everything together. So this is the time in the Rallycast where we kind of try to come up with the title.
You sing a dance.
Yeah. Carl and I actually went into the studio. I was in LA last month and we went into the studio. And that's about as far as I'm going to get. There was no singing though.
Well, there was some singing, but it was, yeah. Aaron is actually here. So he might need to go there too. He's a musician as well as a couple of musicians here at IP Rally. But yeah, the title of this, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of great discussion points here. I love the head for higher ground concept.
Yeah. I was thinking one of, you know, kind of like in the vein of, in a sense that IP was everywhere in a business, but it wasn't in a sense. It's just natural. It's part of the aura, not a forced stage gate requirement.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of the issue, right? There's a lot of things that go on ubiquitously, as we talked about, that people don't understand that it's IP. You probably can come up with an app, have it put on the Apple App Store, which is completely done by because of copyright, and never need to know anything about copyright. So it's this mixture, right, about what becomes kind of autonomous and handled by itself, like everything gets easier over time. And then what are the new, more sophisticated tasks that need to be done? And so, and that starts with value. You have to start by knowing, not just being good at doing something, but understanding where the company needs to go, because that's where the skill set meets the creativity to do something different.
Wonderful.
I don't know if that helped.
It did for me. It that was the cherry on top of the bow around from Bo, actually.
That's right.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bo, for joining us today. I know we can probably talk for another hour. This has been very insightful, very fun as always. Carl, thanks a lot as well for joining early days there in LA. And Bo, I believe that you're in Sweden, so we're both on the pub side of the time zones. So
that's right.
Thank you so much, everyone.